Good evening. It's not often that we have the pleasure of a visitor from Finland. We're very happy to see you, Pertti. We sat at Chikoji for a long time ago. So glad you could come tonight. Let's do introductions around.
Samuel, Randy, Ron, Jesse, Emily, Wendy, Samuel.
We're in the middle of studying this book called Trust in Mind, The Third Patriarchs. Little poem, long poem actually. It seems longer and longer as we go along with this. But it's actually, I've done this a number of times and it gets more and more interesting as I do it, which is the sign of Dharma in my mind. If it's something that you can read and learn from more than one time, then there's something there, some truth that continues to feed us in new ways as we change, then our experience of a sutra changes also and deepens. It's one of the great things about studying the Dharma. There's never any end to it. It continues to give us what we need. We can always go back. So we're at number 46. And I thought we could... There's a bunch that sort of holds together. There's seven of them, I think. And I will read them straight through the way I did last week and then talk about them a little bit. If the eye never sleeps, all dreams will naturally cease. If the mind makes no discriminations, the 10,000 things are as they are, of single essence. That's one. Then, to understand the mystery of this one essence is to be released from all entanglements. When all things are seen equally, the timeless self-essence is reached. No comparison or analogies are possible in this causeless, relationless state. Consider movement stationary and the stationary in motion. Both movement and rest will disappear. When such dualities cease to exist, oneness itself cannot exist. To this ultimate finality, no law or description applies. So if the eye never sleeps, all dreams will naturally cease. In other words, if we stay awake and meet our life as it comes, as it really is, rather than creating stories about it, meeting it with prejudice, meeting it with already having made up our mind, and loading everything that we meet with value judgments. Well, this is a good thing, this is a bad thing, I like this, I don't like that. It's what this whole little poem is about. is how the mind tends to do that, tends to create all kinds of trouble for itself because it doesn't allow itself to relax enough to see that it's all of a piece. We see distinctive, different things, but we don't see that all those things are not separate. So what he's saying is if the eye is really open, if we're awake and paying attention, we'll see how it is. There was in the paper today a letter to the editor. Did any of you see it in the Mercury? It's addressing an article that I didn't see, so I don't quite understand what she's referring to, but and you won't either, but the subject we will get. It starts, as a 16-year-old raised in a politically correct Caucasian family, attending a school where whites are a minority, I like to think that I'm above racism and prejudices. But Leonard Pitts Jr. is right. I can't escape the insidious messages that pervade what I hear in school, on the streets, and what I see in the media. I'm often shocked and horrified when I make a conclusion or judgment and then realize that it can't be rooted in anything other than a groundless prejudice. Unlike 5-year-old Soledad, I am relatively self-aware, but that makes it even scarier. So it's not esoteric knowledge. This is pretty simple. But it takes some courage. It takes some courage to see what's really happening and then to speak up. It takes even greater courage. And yet without it, he calls it entanglements. We're just constantly involved with entanglements, which are artificial. While the real thing is happening underneath. So number 47 says, To understand the mystery of this one essence is to be released from all entanglements. Just to see it already is a huge help, even if it's not a pretty picture. Dropping the effort to make it a pretty picture already creates a much more simple situation. And it isn't that we do it one time and then everything is cool after that. That would be really nice if we could just sort of press a button in ourselves and now it's all, now we've got it. But it's to wake up over and over and over again our whole life long. Which sounds like a lot of work, but it isn't. It's just this moment. Just wake up in this one. And this one becomes the next one, whether we want it to or not. So it's not so hard. It takes a little discipline to notice when we're drifting off to sleep, as we do, as everyone does. And as we have a sitting practice, and we have lots of practice, lots of experience noticing ourselves drifting off. That's very helpful wherever we are to wake up and come back. said, when all things are seen equally, the timeless self-essence is reached. Self-essence is kind of a fancy word. Is talking about seeing that we're all connected and that there is no separation. It's about Buddha's teaching of dependent origination, that we all arise together. You open your eyes and here we all are. I open my eyes and here we all are. It's quite remarkable. Each one of us is opening our eyes into a world in which we're all participating in some way. Buddha said, if you're able to see dependent origination, you'll see me. Me meaning Buddha. And if you see Buddha, you will see dependent origination. You'll see how everything belongs together. Mustang, who is writing the commentary about this, talks about how we are completely equanimous beneath the surface, that we can run around in a very agitated way, but underneath there's some sort of basic calm place in us, what sometimes they call the still point, which we can reference or not. It's a very helpful reference and helpful to remember that in essence we are already in balance and equanimous, and that it's just part of our dream that we are doing all this up and downing stuff, which we enjoy, actually. Chogyam Trungpa's son, the one who is teaching at Shambhala, said this, Sakyong Nipam, he's called Sakyong Nipam Rinpoche, said, the reality that underneath all the flickers of desire and all the dreams we use to fool ourselves into seeking temporary forms of happiness, the reality is that underneath all the flickers of desire and all the dreams we use to fool ourselves into seeking temporary forms of happiness, our mind is clear and cheerful. Sometimes it seems so serious. It's nice to feel that there's good cheer in us. And you meet people who have that quality. My father-in-law was like that. He had a very difficult life, very difficult life. But he met everything with a kind of cheerfulness that took all the sting out of it. Even when he was encountering the Nazis who took over his house in Holland, he made something helpful and useful and good out of it, and always met everyone with this quality of cheerfulness. He was a wonderful teacher for me. I think he was my first teacher, though he never meant to be a teacher at all. But he knew how to be with people and to bring the spirit, a loving spirit, to where he was, whatever the place was, including getting lost in the mountains. We took him up to the Sierras and he managed to get lost overnight. He said it was the most wonderful experience he'd ever had, except that he was so sorry that we were worried about him. Otherwise, he said it was just splendid. And it was. He had a great time. So, it sounds a little pie in the sky, but it's not really. Life is not, for all of its darkness and grimness and fearfulness and anxiety, all of which we're going through so much these days. It's not all like that. And the essence of it isn't like that at all. Whatever's going on. So then he goes on to about comparisons and analogies are not possible in this causeless, relationless state. You can't say it, really. It's like trying to talk about what a ruler is like. It's a funny example, but you've got a stick, and it's got all these measurements very carefully laid out on it. And it tells you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way up to 12. So you say, oh, I know what the ruler is. It's this. But if you flip it over, there's nothing on it. So what's the real ruler? How can you even talk about the real ruler? The essence of the ruler is somewhere in all of that, but it isn't one thing or the other. Form and emptiness is even closer than that. That the form, whatever form we pick up, actually is emptiness already. But it's really not talk aboutable. So that's why we end up chanting it. Consider movement stationary and the stationary in motion, both movement and rest, disappear. So if you begin to really look at opposites that way, then they it becomes a paradox. And if we're asleep, then we tend to choose one side. Well, it's this. It's this side. I know it's this side. I see it, and it's got to be this way. And then somebody else says, no, no, it's over here. It's like this. But paradox takes them both together, and the mind expands to take it in, all of it in, not just one side or the other side. That's really the essence of this whole teaching. When such dualities cease to exist, and this is the trick, then oneness itself cannot exist. Because it too becomes a thing. And then you have oneness and not oneness. And you're doing the same thing. Just a mind trick. So that paradox includes all of it. Not just one side or the other. Even oneness is too small. It's like when I was a child and the grown-ups would talk about God, and I would be so embarrassed that they would use this tiny word for something so huge that you couldn't even talk about it. It's something like that. And then he finishes by saying, to this ultimate finality, no law or description applies. So it's like Thich Nhat Hanh's wonderful description of paper. We have this paper that includes everything. The rain, the clouds, the sky, the sea, and all the things that went into making this, the huge production of it, and the falling apart of it and the blending back into where whatever else it becomes and what it's been through the millennia of the universe and what it was before there was a Big Bang. This piece of paper includes everything. And so does everything else. So we can pick up each thing with tremendous respect and awe that we are all here with it together. And, as he says, trust it. Trust our situation, even though we don't really know. So that's this part. It went together very nicely, this little set of them. It goes to 50, we went to 52. So are there questions? Comments? Ron?
The line that said when the I does not exist, was that the I as in?
Yes, the EYE.
The capital I, is there a difference?
It's the EYE. Well, is there a difference?
Can't you see us?
We're the ones who see, aren't we? Yeah.
Is it when that ceases to exist, then dreams will also stop? If there were no ego eye, then maybe there wouldn't be. Figurative speech. Waking, in the waking state, I wonder really if even the Buddha, who was supposedly completely enlightened, if he didn't have dreams when he slept, if he slept, since I was sort of total speculation and probably doesn't serve any useful purpose. I think maybe what he meant by dreams was more abstract, kind of the construction of the interpretations and that sort of thing, just like you read the letter. Well, you read the letter by the young teenager. I didn't happen to read the letter, but I did read Leonard Pitt's excellent column, and it's true. I mean, sometimes we can't escape that our parents and our society sort of implanted in our minds in a very insidious ways, ways that we really don't remember, because it's also goes back to when we were so young and we heard people say.
We don't even know where it comes from.
Once in a while, I'll catch myself.
Yeah.
Something, some kind of thought or will come out, and I'll say, It's there. I'm not so open-minded.
Well, we are our culture. We are our society. And if we're asleep in it, then we just reproduce the whole thing. And we are our family. And if we're asleep in our family, then we reproduce the whole thing. So waking up is a really important thing to be trying to do. Because otherwise we perpetuate so much suffering.
That line also interested me, if the eye does not sleep in the mind, I don't remember the rest, but your comments. I was reminded of the title of the book, and I didn't read the book. The title was a teaching for me, and it was called The Eye of I. E-Y-E, capital letter I. The Eye of I, which I think is... And the letter from the newspaper was a great example of that, in that I generally don't see what the I, just the EYE sees. No.
Yeah.
No, it's colored by the I, ego I, that interprets or misinterprets or spins everything to the 10,000 thing.
Yeah.
Or the 10 bazillion thing. So again, thank you for the teaching tonight. It's reminded me of things to be reminded of.
Right.
The eye of I.
The eye of I.
That egoic
sense
of Randy.
Yeah.
And it don't see the truth.
Well, the other side of it is that everything we see is the truth. So it's not that we can see everything once we're enlightened. That isn't what enlightenment is. It's just being willing to acknowledge our limitations to start with, and then to be willing to meet whatever is before us. As ourself, as Buddha. I think getting rid of the ego trying to get rid of the ego is doesn't work, because there isn't an ego to get rid of.
Who's trying to get rid of it?
Yeah, well, lots of people are doing that. Try to cut it off, but there isn't anything to cut off. It's just one more idea. Britt?
I'm not sure if I have a question, but both of your comments reminded me. I read about a study in which they had people alternately read cliches or fill in the blank on a cliche. And then at the end of the study, they asked them, did you read this word or did you fill in the blank? And it was a huge error rate. People couldn't remember what they saw and what they imagined. And I think maybe that's just part of the human animals we are. We frequently need to fill in what we missed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of built in. And I guess it has its downsides. We don't always know when we filled in.
That's a good point. That's kind of scary, isn't it?
Yeah, it was only about 20% of the time people couldn't remember. We were wrong about whether they saw mm-hmm. it or whether they understood it. But that's pretty startling. 20%.
Interesting.
But it wasn't really startling, so. Just putting that out there.
Yeah, fascinating.
I see this in conflict situations a lot, but I had an experience once where there was some difficulty at work with somebody, and the guy was going to throw me out of his office or something, and my boss reacted one way, why didn't you come and talk to me? I just kind of finally left. But then he finally kind of chewed me out, his perception of the whole situation, I thought I was, am I crazy? Because it was so, I had filled in the, in fact, you know, I couldn't believe what he was saying. But he believed it was true. And then, you know, without going into particulars, and then I kind of went back, well, was it really like that? Well, maybe it was. Maybe I'm the one who distorted it from my own point of view. You see this all the time. And,
Yeah?
Relationships depend on these. Everybody is just living in their own world and showing them ways all the time.
I have a friend who does conflict resolution. I saw her yesterday, and she was saying that most conflicts are so simple, and they're really just what you're describing. People don't understand each other. And if they really could stop and listen to what the other person is saying, then they could have some common ground. But they don't listen. They just hold back, and they already know. And then that person already knows, and they're just like this. She said it's the hardest thing to get people to really communicate with each other, to say what they know, what they believe, without adding a lot of extra blame. It's one of the precepts, no praising self and blaming others. But we sure do it a lot.
There's a Bible verse, I think, of it, and it goes, the sins of the father will be visited upon the son. And I just think about the conditioning that's just handed down and handed down, yeah, like a relay race. And the programming and instead of seeing what you want to see or expect to see or based on.
Yeah.
So, pretty interesting.
It is. It is. As the little girl said, it's scary. And then you raise children and you see it coming up in your children. You know, the things that have passed through the family are coming up again in different ways. It's really something.
But to see the Buddha in it, that would make it interesting.
Yes.
To see the interplay of it.
Yes.
Without judgment on that.
Right. It's just Buddha life. All of it. Well, it's 8 o'clock.